From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And tonight, the third Democratic presidential debate will take place in Houston, Texas. 10 candidates qualified. Elizabeth Warren comes to Houston ascending in popularity, but Joe Biden still leads in polling. The two will share a stage tonight for the first time. The third frontrunner, Bernie Sanders, will be there as well. NPR political correspondent Asma Khalid is in Houston. Asma, what will you be looking for?
You hit the nail on the head right there. I mean, this is the first time that Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren and former Vice President Joe Biden will be on the same debate stage. And that dynamic will be fascinating to watch. You know, the two of them have had a long history. They have clashed before on bankruptcy legislation. And even in this campaign, they're both fundamentally running different styles of campaign. Elizabeth Warren talks often on the stump about the need for big structural change. And Joe Biden has sort of talked a lot more about the need for a continuation of the Obama administration's legacy. I get the hunch that there will not necessarily be direct attacks on Joe Biden from Elizabeth Warren because she knows that that did not necessarily bode well for some of the candidates who did hit Joe Biden more directly in the previous debates.
Well, and I'm remembering in a previous debate, she was standing right next to Bernie Sanders. They share a lot of the same thinking, and it was almost as if they, you know, went back to back together as a team, you know, taking on the other candidates. It'll be interesting to see what happens here. Also on the stage, Senators Cory Booker of New Jersey and Kamala Harris of California, Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, Bernie Sanders, South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg, Obama Housing Secretary Julian Castro, former Representative Beto O'Rourke of Texas, and tech investor Andrew Yang. And that's all the time we have for our segment. The point is that there's a lot of people still on the stage. What are you looking for any of them?
You know, when you talk to campaigns, some of them have made this point that it's still a really congested debate stage. It's going to be crowded. The actual number of candidates is still on par with what we had in the first two debates. And so some of them are trying to downplay expectations, saying like, look, you know, we just sort of have to grin and bear it, get through this, but we don't anticipate that it's going to lead to sort of a huge bump in momentum for anybody. You know, one campaign told me something I think rather interesting. They actually think that in some ways the debates have become somewhat more of a liability. They say, you know, some candidates have actually seen their prospects dim after having a really viral moment in a debate, and they'll point to someone like California Senator Kamala Harris, who in the first debate clashed directly with Joe Biden on the issue of busing. She got an immediate bump, but then over time, we haven't seen her fortunes rise in the polls. Mm-hmm. And anecdotally, when I've gone out and talked to African-American voters, I did hear from some folks who felt like they did not appreciate what Kamala Harris did in that debate, and in some cases, they had been considering both her and Biden, and then leaned more toward Biden as a result of what they saw between the two of them in that debate.
So a cautionary note. I mentioned the ceasefire between Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren in other debates. Do you think he's been slipping a little in the polls while she's been surging? According to some NPR reporting, more Democrats say they like her than any other candidate, although when they're actually polled, Biden still continues to lead in almost all of the polls. Do you think that their ceasefire, though, may end tonight if he really needs to get ahead?
I don't think so. I spoke with Sanders' campaign manager the other day, and, you know, he made it clear that they don't find it effective to attack an ally who is on the same page as them around public policy. Yeah. That being said, you know, they do want to make some differentiations between themselves and Warren. And so, you know, even to us on the phone, he made the point that Sanders has run this grassroots-focused campaign for a long time, and they feel like that makes him unique, that he's been saying very consistently the same message for years.
Yeah. Overall, the split tonight seems to be between Biden, the more moderate, seen by many progressives, as just not wanting to do enough in this moment, seen by his supporters as just the person to maybe woo some former Trump supporters in 2020. How much do you think we'll see that split tonight? Will some progressives maybe listen to what others have been saying, others within the party saying it's too soon to go as far as, let's say, Medicare for All?
I think the major argument that a lot of candidates are going to be trying to make on stage is around this notion of electability. When you look at why voters often support Joe Biden, it will come down to the idea that they want a candidate who will beat Donald Trump. Now, the Biden campaign disagrees with this being sort of the main reason folks are supporting the former vice president. But I think that we'll likely see some other candidates because we've already seen kind of precursors of this. I was at the New Hampshire Democratic State Party Convention the other day, and we saw so many candidates make the argument that you cannot choose a candidate right now in this moment just because it's the quote-unquote safe option. You need to choose the person that you genuinely believe in. When it comes to Joe Biden, though, in terms of moderates and progressives, look, the Biden campaign has told us pretty bluntly that they do anticipate Biden will defend and continue to defend the Obama administration's record. And we saw some candidates hit that record, whether it was around health care or immigration in previous debates. So whether some folks interpret that as being too moderate or not, we'll see. But his campaign did tell us that he will do that.
NPR political correspondent Asma Khalid, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, in addition to the presidential race next year, there will be House races and Senate races. And one of the most vulnerable sitting senators is in the state of Maine, Republican Susan Collins, whose long political career is built on her reputation as a centrist. But that image is under threat, both by controversial votes Collins has taken and a polarizing Trump presidency that has enraged and energized Democrats and aligned activists. Maine Public Radio's Steve Missler reports.
Senator Collins hasn't officially announced whether she'll seek re-election next year, but she's acting and talking as if it's a near certainty.
I am laying the groundwork and certainly would run an aggressive campaign should I decide to run.
Collins' long political career has been constructed on a reputation that she's not too right, not too left. She's in the middle, like most Mainers. And voters here have rewarded her for it, sending her back to Congress with landslide victories in each of her three re-election bids. But her image is under siege, and so the 66-year-old Collins has been trying to bolster it.
My hope is that both parties can get back to the middle. I think the middle is where most Americans are.
On a recent Maine Public Radio call-in show, Collins was asked whether Donald Trump encapsulates the values of the Republican Party. 3 years ago, Collins contemplated a similar question after Trump won the Republican nomination for president. She responded with a column in The Washington Post, which she later discussed in an interview with PBS NewsHour.
He lacks the temperament, the judgment, the knowledge, and the self-restraint to be our next president.
The contrasts in Collins' responses help illustrate part of the re-election challenge she faces now. The president may be a polarizing figure, but polls show he's popular with Republican voters. In the aftermath of his surprising win, which included a historic victory in Maine's more rural 2nd Congressional District, where Collins lives, spurred questions about the senator's political future.
I think Susan Collins is done in Maine. I think her decision to go against the wishes of the Maine Republicans really cooked her goose.
That was former Maine Republican Governor Paul LePage speaking on conservative radio station WGAN shortly after Trump's 2016 election victory. LePage, frequently described as a Trump prototype, has since backed off his political obituary for Collins, and he's praised her for a vote that could have electoral consequences for the senator in 2020.
Mr. President, I will vote to confirm Judge Kavanaugh.
And I am so furious at our senator. I miss rational Republicans.
Voters like Gail Foss were upset at Collins' vote to confirm Supreme Court Judge Brett Kavanaugh last October. Many saw it as a betrayal of her pro-choice stance on abortion. Activists had previously viewed her as persuadable, and sometimes their pressure campaigns and protests seemed to work. In 2017, Collins opposed the GOP attempt to repeal the Affordable Care Act, and she was greeted by a spontaneous standing ovation at the Bangor airport.
It really was so heartwarming and affirming.
But in 2017, Collins voted for a GOP tax law that repealed the Affordable Care Act mandate that individuals have health insurance or pay a penalty. That vote touched off an acceleration in the breakup between Collins and liberal activists. And the persuasion protests have largely faded and now been replaced with ads like this.
And I voted for, but now she's taking all this big corporate money and voted to give them $100 billion in tax breaks. It's not fair.
Liberal groups are also highlighting Collins' campaign donors, which include billionaires like Robert and Diana Mercer, who fund Breitbart News and are among the president's biggest financial backers, and members of the Federalist Society, who advise the president on judicial nominees like Kavanaugh. Meanwhile, the Kavanaugh vote spawned crowdfunding campaigns that generated more than $4 million, money that will go to Collins' Democratic challenger. Among the contenders is Maine House Speaker Sarah Gideon, who attacked Collins' much-discussed independence in her campaign launch video.
Getting things done for Mainers is what we're elected to do. Not falling in line behind the demands of someone else. It doesn't matter if that person is Paula Page, Mitch McConnell, or Donald Trump.
University of Maine political science professor Mark Brewer says Gideon and Democratic hopefuls like Betsy Sweet have a tough path to defeat Collins. Brewer believes that despite a morning consult poll showing a 16-point drop in her favorability to 45%, Collins and her brand are still formidable. He says she'll have to navigate the steady chaos of a Trump presidency. But how?
That's the million-dollar question, right? And I don't know that anybody has the answer to that, including the senator herself and her reelection campaign staff. I mean, it's an incredibly difficult needle she's trying to thread here.
Collins will decide if she's up to the task with a formal reelection announcement in October. For Here and Now, I'm Steve Missler in Portland, Maine.
There are new calls today for the British Parliament to reconvene after a couple of major developments. First, a Scottish court ruled that Prime Minister Boris Johnson's shutdown of Parliament was unlawful, implying that he had lied to the Queen about why he wanted to shut down Parliament. Second, a secret document outlining the worst fears of the government in the case of a no-deal Brexit was released, and it isn't pretty. It warns of food and medicine shortages and protests and road blockages on the border between Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK, and Ireland, which is part of the EU. We're joined now by the Irish ambassador to the United States, Daniel Mulhall, in Washington. Ambassador, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to talk to you.
Well, what are your biggest concerns, or what are the biggest concerns of the Irish government at this point about a possible no-deal Brexit?
Well, the problem is that this is an unprecedented situation. I don't think any country has ever left a free trade area as advanced as the European Union and put nothing in its place. For example, imagine if the United States were to leave NAFTA and put nothing in its place. Think of the disruption that would cause. I mean, the US has replaced NAFTA with the USMCA, and that's currently undergoing ratification. But meanwhile, the NAFTA agreement remains in place so that you have continuity. The problem is that if Britain leaves the European Union on the 31st of October without a deal, it goes from having a completely smooth and clear trading relationship with its nearest neighbours to having nothing, to having to start afresh. Mm-hmm. And this is, nobody is quite sure how this will work out. But the documents produced by the British government this week were certainly alarming. But the problem is that there's an uncertainty factor in that nobody can be sure because this kind of thing has never happened before.
Are you worried about violence on the border between Northern Ireland and Ireland?
I don't like to talk about violence. We have two concerns. The first is that we have a major trading relationship with the United Kingdom, which has been operating within the single market for the last 20 years, completely free of any restrictions. If you introduce a situation where Britain is no longer in the customs union, no longer in the single market, no longer in the European Union, our trade with Britain is bound to be affected to a negative degree, and that will be economically damaging for us. But the more serious political problem is that there will be a great deal of uncertainty on the border between Ireland and Northern Ireland, because if the UK is outside the customs union, Ireland will be obliged to protect the European single market. So the problem will be, how do we maintain an open border in those circumstances? Our government's determined to maintain an open border because we think that having any kind of border controls on the island of Ireland would be risky. It would be politically risky. It would be economically disruptive, of course. That's one thing. That's important too. But the political risk that would entail is the one that we are really concerned about, because peace in Northern Ireland has saved so many lives over the last 21 years. The United States played a big role in 1998 in bringing about the Good Friday Agreement through the chairmanship of Senator George Mitchell. But that peace is fragile because there hasn't been a government in Northern Ireland now for 2.5 years or more. And this means that there's a bit of a political vacuum. And if you toss into that political vacuum the disruptions created by Brexit, it just ratchets up the political atmosphere in Northern Ireland in an unhappy way, an unwelcome way. And that's what we fear.
But these are fears that have been around now for 3 years since the Brexit referendum. And it doesn't seem like any plan has been put into place of like what's actually going to happen as soon as the end of next month. Why do you think that hasn't happened yet? Nobody's come to an agreement about what to do about the Irish border.
Because it's easy to say we're leaving the EU, but after 45 years of European Union membership, leaving has turned out to be a far trickier prospect than anybody imagined when the referendum was taking place. When the referendum was on, I was ambassador in the UK, and there was very little attention paid to the Irish border. The assumption was everything will be fine, don't worry, no problems. I did try to warn people at that time that there would be difficulties, and those difficulties have become the crux of the issue between the UK and the European Union, because Ireland is the only place in Europe where there's a land border between the European Union and the United Kingdom. And the problem is that we had an agreement, by the way, between the previous government and the European Union on a withdrawal agreement, which included a backstop that would guarantee there would never be border controls on the island of Ireland. The current British government wants to scrap that backstop. It says it has alternative ideas that could achieve the same end, but we are still await proposals. And our Prime Minister, Leo Varadkar, said publicly that we would welcome alternative proposals, but they have to be legally watertight. They can't just be political promises. We have at the moment a backstop which gives us legal certainty, and if there is to be an alternative, it has to achieve the same certainty rather than just being a political promise.
Do you think that the government of the UK is going to come up with a new deal before the end of October? They've been told by the British Parliament that they cannot crash out at the end of October without a deal, and they're supposed to go to Brussels in mid-October and try to reach a new agreement. Do you think that that will happen?
Well, we certainly hope so, because Ireland would be the country, apart from the UK, that would be most affected by a disastrous Brexit of the kind that a no deal would bring about. So we earnestly hope that we will be able to find solutions. But ultimately, we had an agreement. The British government says it's unable to adhere to that agreement. Therefore, it's really up to them to come up with new proposals as to how they think that agreement can be replaced, and then for us to have those negotiations and hopefully reach a solution. I take some comfort in the fact that my experience, and I've been 40 years now in the Irish diplomatic service, I spent a lot of time in Brussels at meetings, and the European Union has a great capacity for achieving agreements, even when you think it's not going to be possible to do so. And therefore, if the British government is genuine in seeking a deal, I would have some hope that we will be able to find some solutions. But it really does require the British government to specify clearly what it wants and how it hopes to achieve the outcome. The EU have said we have two concerns. One is to protect the European single market, and the second is to protect peace in Northern Ireland and the Good Friday Agreement. Those two aims would have been achieved by the withdrawal agreement and the backstop. Without those aims being achieved, no agreement can be reached, in my view.
Do you think there's a possibility that there will be a second referendum for the British people to decide whether they really want a Brexit?
I couldn't possibly speculate on that. I mean,
would you like there to be one?
I represent the Irish government. Look, we have benefited greatly from EU membership over the last 45 years. Our country has been transformed. And part of that transformation has been that it has led to much better relations between Britain and Ireland, because we've been partners around that table in Brussels over the last 45 years, which has allowed us to come together to deliver peace to Northern Ireland. So we like the status quo. We would like to see Britain either, well, if it wishes to remain in the EU, we'd be delighted. But if it leaves the EU, we want to see Britain as closely aligned as possible to the European Union so as to minimise the disruption to relations within Europe and to relations between Britain and Ireland and on the island of Ireland. Those are our aims. I mean, how exactly those aims are to be achieved, well, really, that's a matter for the British people, the British Parliament and the British government to determine.
Of all the hypotheticals that are out there, I have to ask you about another one. Is it possible at any point in the future that Ireland would just all be one, that's a solution to this problem, is for Northern Ireland and Ireland to just be part of Ireland instead of part of the UK?
Well, the Good Friday Agreement of 1998 provides for the prospect of a referendum in the future when there is evidence that there might be a majority in Northern Ireland that would favour a united Ireland. And both governments have agreed to respect any decision by the people of Northern Ireland about their constitutional future. That prospect is there, and we have to wait and see what happens in the years ahead. Obviously, the way Brexit works out will have an effect on thinking in Northern Ireland. But for me and for our government, that is an issue for the future and not an issue for today. The issue for today is how to avoid damage being done by Brexit to the precious peace we've developed in Northern Ireland and to the very close relationship that has developed between Ireland and the UK, because those relations are vital for both countries.
I want to ask you one more thing, Ambassador, that has nothing to do with Brexit, which is you're the ambassador in the United States. Obviously, Ireland and the US are very close.
Yes.
However, the recent polls that have come out of Ireland show that President Trump has something like a 13% approval rating in your country. Has that made your job at all difficult, that our leaders are not popular in your country?
The job of an ambassador is to deal with the situation as you find it. We don't determine who the president of the United States is. You don't determine who the Irish prime minister is or the Irish president. What we have to do is to deal with the administration and the Congress as we find it. And I have good relations with people in the administration. I talk to them on a regular basis. I try to make sure that they understand Ireland's thinking when it comes to a range of issues on trade and on Brexit and on Northern Ireland and so forth. I have not found my job to be in any way impossible because of the fact that there are clear political divisions. Those divisions exist in all countries. After all, I was the ambassador to the United Kingdom during the Brexit referendum, and that was a pretty divisive time.
Which one's been more difficult?
So I'm used to dealing with situations where not everyone in the political spectrum agrees with each other. Look, that's just part of life. You know, you deal with the field of play as you find it, and not as you might want to design it yourself.
Is being the Irish ambassador to the UK right now considered a hardship assignment? Because
it's obviously challenging. It was challenging when I was there. Challenging now. It's always challenging. You know, it's our nearest neighbor, and my colleague there does an extremely good job. But obviously, it's a time when things are going through a certain state of flux. But I think there's a commitment and a determination on our part and on the part of the British government that whatever happens, we have to have the closest possible relationship with our nearest neighbor. Because after all, the two countries are co-guarantors of a very important peace process in Northern Ireland. And whatever happens, we have to make sure that peace process is preserved. And in that, we enjoy the support of US administrations over the last 25, 30 years. Nobody wants to see the clock turn back in Northern Ireland. So that's something that I think is vitally important and will remain important whatever happens to Brexit in the next 6 weeks.
That is Irish Ambassador to the US, Daniel Mulhall. Ambassador, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Diallo Riddle and Bashir Salahuddin are African-American TV industry veterans, a writing and performing team who've worked at major outlets like NBC and HBO. Now they've created two different shows for two different cable channels airing on the same night. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans caught up with them to talk about them. They're Sherman's Showcase on IFC and Southside on Comedy Central.
One series, Sherman Showcase, depicts a fictional 40-year-old Soul Train-style music program where even the opening credits are filled with jokes.
Today's episode is brought to you by VHS, the future of film. Watch movies in your own house for just $200 a tape.
The other series, Southside, centers on two friends who graduated from community college but are stuck working dead-end jobs in a rent-to-own business in Chicago.
I was supposed to be congratulating my brother and Simon last week for graduating, but then Simon had to go and do a bid.
A bid? I was only in there for like 10 hours. Stop exaggerating.
Well, that was 10 hours more than the rest of us here. So anyway, Simon K., good job.
You act like it didn't take him 8 years to finish community college.
He's got a point there.
Come on, give it up for the idiot, yeah? I went to school for 8 years. I'm stupid.
Both shows were co-created by writing and performing partners Diallo Riddle and Bashir Salahuddin. And both shows air on the same night, Wednesdays, within a half hour of each other in prime time. At a time when diversity in TV remains a hot topic, the fact that two African-American writers have pulled off this feat feels like a lottery win. And even Riddle can't say for sure how it worked out this way.
We lucked out. I mean, in the sense that we found two networks that were willing to both trust us and follow through on their end.
Salahuddin, who plays host Sherman McDaniel on Sherman Showcase, has a different perspective.
I think in some ways you make your own luck. Part of it is us being advanced enough in our careers to demand that we're considered a certain way.
Each program mines comedy from a different part of Black life. IFC's Sherman Showcase is sort of a sketch comedy show in disguise. The other show, Southside on Comedy Central, mines comedy from an eccentric group of characters in an often stereotyped community. Salahuddin was born and raised in Chicago. Riddle grew up in Atlanta. They met at Harvard University and became writing partners, eventually landing writing jobs on NBC's Late Night with Jimmy Fallon. The two earned Emmy nominations, but they've had setbacks, including a show they spent years developing at HBO, which never aired. Salahuddin says their current success and the triumphs of other comedy creators of color is far from an overnight thing.
It's a great moment, but I think it's a moment that's been worked really hard on by a lot of different people from a lot of different places. There were a lot of no's. There were a lot of doors that were knocked on. There were a lot of people told no, and then people just kept knocking, and they kept getting better.
These days, the range of comedy shows created by and starring people of color is significant, from FX's Atlanta to HBO's Insecure, Random Acts of Flyness, and A Black Lady Sketch Show. These shows are more adventurous, even absurdist, than the traditional comedies many black performers have been allowed to create in the past. Riddle hopes it's a moment that'll last longer than the 1990s heyday of black-centered shows like Fox's In Living Color.
Even though there are a lot more of us, I think the personalities of the individual creators comes shining through on each of these projects. And, you know, I always say I don't know how long this will last, but I do feel like right now we're in a very good place. And hopefully, maybe this time it'll stick around for a little bit longer.
I'm Eric Degg.
Well, let's take a break from the news now for a classical edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions. Joining us today is Vic DiGeronimo, the host of Classic Mornings at WILL in Urbana, Illinois, my hometown. Hi, Vic.
Hello, Jeremy.
Well, it's great to have you back, and you've got something a little more interesting than, I guess, a pumpkin spice latte for us. This is a special September selection of classical music.
Yeah, we're at the transition here between late summer and early autumn, and I think this music will go real well with the transition time.
Okay, well, the first one, which listeners will certainly recognize, is Autumn from Antonio Vivaldi's The Four Seasons. I know this so well because I played it on the cello when I was young and put together a little chamber music group, and we put this on. And I remember that we had to bring in one of our music teachers as the violinist, and somebody said to me afterwards, well, she did a great job. So, but tell us about this one.
Well, what you're hearing is the sound of the hunt, and that's how Vivaldi concludes the concerto. He has three pictures. The first one is the merriment that goes along with the harvest and with the celebration of autumn. The second movement, from perhaps too much celebrating, is sleep. And then the third movement is the hunt. And you hear, just with the use of string instruments, you hear the dogs and you hear the horses and you hear the hunting horns. And it's a pretty exciting finale for the hunt and for autumn.
Okay, well, the next one that you have brought us is called The Last Rose of Summer. This version is by Friedrich von Flotow from his opera Marta. And that soprano that you hear there is Renee Fleming. What is she singing about?
This is a poem that was written by the Irish poet, singer, songwriter Thomas Moore. And it is indeed about the last rose of summer, but it's more of a metaphor for someone who is the last of their family, their circle of friends, But indeed, it is about the autumn, even though it's a metaphor. And it's probably one of the greatest hits of the early 19th century. It was written during Beethoven's lifetime. Beethoven used the tune twice. Contemporaries of Beethoven used the tune. Mendelssohn wrote variations on it, Felix Mendelssohn. Mikhail Glinka, the Russian composer, wrote variations on it. And then comes the opera Marta in 1847 by Flotow, and he just incorporated it into the opera as kind of a showstopper for one of his singers. And we have the opportunity to hear a soprano singing it in the middle of an opera, which is what Renee Fleming does here with The Last Rose of Summer.
With such a beautiful voice. The next one that you've brought us is an Italian's take on fall. This is Autumn from Giuseppe Verdi's opera, The Sicilian Vespers. I have to say, it sounds more like spring than autumn to me, Vic. What do you think?
Autumn is the finale of this ballet within an opera. If that sounds strange to you, Verdi was writing this for the Paris Opera. The Parisians have always asked for a ballet as a part of their opera. This is a grand ballet, The Four Seasons, and it concludes with autumn. It's sort of a lighter moment, if you will, in a very dramatic and very intense opera of the Sicilian Vespers.
Okay, the next one is from Alexander Glazunov's ballet, The Seasons. This is also called Autumn. I guess it reminds you that when you are done with the summer and you get into autumn, you're moving very quickly. Things have to get done. You're back to work in the autumn.
Well, again, this is the celebratory autumn. Mm-hmm. And Glazunov, just like Verdi, concludes the ballet with autumn rather than with winter, which is what Vivaldi does. And Alexander Glazunov was known for being a great orchestrator, not only of his music, but he orchestrated music of Tchaikovsky and Borodin at one point. And so here's this grand orchestra celebrating autumn in all of its festivities. There are so many festivals and there's so much merrymaking and celebrating that goes on in autumn around the world. And here, it's a part of that celebration in the music of Glazunov.
Okay, well, last but not least, we have a modern piece. This is also called Autumn. This is by Stephen Reynolds, who wrote it in the 1980s. You can almost picture that last yellow leaf floating down a stream.
This is a piece that I understand is uncharacteristic of Stephen Reynolds, who writes a lot of experimental music, and that's according to the pianist Stephen Huff. And what he was trying to do, I understand, this is one of what are called two poems in homage to Fauré, Gabriel Fauré, the late 19th, early 20th century French composer, was use the language of Fauré in writing a piece in The Song of Autumn. And it kind of reminds me of the film from the 1980s by Bertrand Tavernier, A Sunday in the Country, about a French painter, which takes place in late summer, early autumn, and you could just sort of see the colors of a still life, and it's sort of reflecting on the autumn in this piece by Stephen Reynolds.
What do you hear as the main difference as over the centuries these composers have tried to make sense of autumn?
I think there are more similarities than differences, and they're looking at the harvest, and they're looking at festivals, and they're looking at celebration as the warm weather and that portion of the year comes to an end before the anticipated winter. And not that that doesn't have a beauty to it, but I think musically speaking, let's enjoy this, let's celebrate it. If we haven't done enough, let's make sure we make up for lost time.
Let's just be happy that the classical composers that we admire didn't grow up in Southern California, where they wouldn't have had seasons to write about. That is Vic DiGeronimo, who hosts Classic Mornings at WILL in Urbana, Illinois. Thanks so much for joining us once again.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Jeremy.
Today is the public launch of the Maryland Lynching Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the first such commission in the country, established by a bipartisan bill earlier this year, empowered to find out the truth about the state's lynching history and then address it. Sherilyn Ifill will be the keynote speaker at tonight's event. She's president and director counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, author of the seminal book on lynchings, On the Courthouse Lawn. And if her name is familiar, she is cousin to the late PBS anchor Gwen Ifill. Sherilyn Ifill, so sorry for your loss.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Gwen is really an American treasure.
Yeah. And talk about your work. When the commission was created, Maryland acknowledged at least 40 African Americans were lynched in that state from the mid-19th century through 1933. The commission is going to have a staff member from the Office of the Attorney General authorized to issue subpoenas for documents and witnesses. But this is a long time ago, so who might need to be called forth to talk about this?
Well, it's an excellent question. You know, where is the mystery buried?
Yeah.
And actually, it's hiding in plain sight. You know, the name of my book, On the Courthouse Lawn, was designed to expose the truth about lynching, particularly in Maryland, but in many places in the country. They very often happen on the courthouse lawn. And so a kind of silence fell within the white community in the days following the lynchings, and even to the point of denying that some of these events happened. Law enforcement would essentially say that, you know, they couldn't find any witnesses. And so part of the uncovering and the subpoenaing is to find the information. And it could be information held in archives and documents. It could be the burial place of lynching victims who were often, you know, buried in obscure graveyards. It's not so long ago that there's not documentation or other information or artifacts that are relevant to piecing together the story.
We know that coroners often just said that victims of lynching died at the hands of parties unknown when everyone knew who the parties were. And we're hearing from people already, Carla Wynn, who went to a public meeting that's already been held at Harford Community College. She's an academic advisor at that school. And she talks about how there are families for whom this is still unspoken of and yet very present. You know, grandma told mom, who told the children, pain and loss and horror, but you can't talk about it.
Well, there was silence in both the black community and the white community. The silence in the black community was, this is not something that you speak about, but we're going to tell you what happened because it's also a cautionary tale about the danger that you are in if you walk outside the bounds of citizenship that the white community has set for black people. And then in the white community, there was also a silence, and that silence was made up of some fear, I suppose, of being caught, a little bit of shame, I think, for some. But it became a bond between people. And when I was doing my research in the late 1990s and early aughts, that silence was still quite thick. And we're losing the last physical eyewitnesses to some of these events. But it's not too late.
Well, so there's the truth part of the commission. For the healing powers, we know that has not only for those whose families were victims, but those whose families were perpetrators. But now we get to the reconciliation part. Do we know what that looks like from this commission? Is it reparations? What does reconciliation mean?
Well, the charge of the commission doesn't quite get us there. The commission is charged with submitting a report with findings and recommendations by December 2021. What you should be thinking about is how can the breach and the harm be repaired? And some of that is about the families of victims. But, you know, lynchings were meant to terrorize whole communities. So the repair that has to happen actually is community repair. And there are many ways to do that. There can be apologies from local law enforcement that failed to do their job.
So county sheriffs or jailers allowed the mobs to take the men from jail that
That's
they
right,
hung?
From jail.
Yeah.
The newspapers that in some instances refused to report about lynching events that happened very close to their publishing offices. These are the kinds of things that should be really revealed and unearthed. And then finally, there has to be repair in the public space. And that may mean putting markers at the unmarked graves of lynching victims that describes events that happened that stand in such sharp contrast to what the courthouse represents in terms of justice.
We know that Brian Stevenson is already running the Equal Justice Initiative, just a wonderful nonprofit that's memorializing lynching sites. I'm not going to ask why is this needed, because obviously as much as possible is needed, but what does it mean that this is a state-run Truth and Reconciliation Commission?
It is really vital that this not be seen as some private effort, and the state has to take responsibility for its own history that is not pleasant. And so to have the imprimatur of the state of Maryland behind the effort to learn more about these events and to propose and adopt recommendations on how we address what we've learned is hugely powerful and important and historic.
Sherrilyn Ifill, President and Director Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. Also, she'll be the keynote speaker at the public launch of the Maryland Lynching Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the first state-run commission of its kind. Sherrilyn, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.